funds or exchange-traded funds, ETFs, that are bundles of stocks and bonds picked by a manager or by an algorithm. You can invest in real estate, both to live in and rent out. You can invest in businesses through becoming a partner or lending. There are plenty of ways beyond these to invest, but they are either riskier, require more day-to-day attention, or are dubious ethically. Day traders can make and lose lots of money, but by definition, that's how they spend their days. Financial products like derivatives, like bundles of subprime mortgages, for example, promised great returns until they nearly brought the U.S. economy down. You are free to invest your capital any way you want. This chapter simply offers some guidance about investment opportunities that fit the Your Money, Your Life model. Investing does not mean readopting the more is better mentality and learning how to make a killing with your capital. Having followed the steps in this program, you know how much is enough for you, and the purpose of your investment program will be to assure you that you will have that amount and then some for the rest of your life. This is about becoming knowledgeable and sophisticated about investment instruments that can provide sufficient income over time to assure that your basics are covered. Becoming knowledgeable and sophisticated means learning enough to free yourself from the fear and confusion that pervade the realm of personal investments, from your Uncle Mervyn's hot tips to the barrage of bad advice that comes through all your devices. Nothing in this section is to be construed as specific investment advice, but is simply to highlight common ways to store wealth for the long run. The information here, like that in the rest of the book, is based on personal experience and popular FI community strategies, and is intended as guidelines, principles, and educational information. A brief glossary. You will not learn anything about playing the market in this chapter, just some guiding principles for FIers to help you make informed, conservative choices. Here's a glossary of a few common terms you'll want to understand. Risk tolerance. How much risk of losing money can you tolerate before your investments cost you sleep, leaving you awake at night worrying about whether losses will send you back to work to rebuild wealth? The spectrum ranges from conservative investors who do not want to risk their capital at all to aggressive ones who are willing to risk all their capital for the promise of significant returns. FIers will inherently avoid the latter choice. Before the crossover point, some of you may risk more for greater returns, others not. After the crossover point, you want to maximize passive income while minimizing risk so you can pay the least attention possible to your money. Your risk tolerance may have to do with your age, your personality, how marketable your skills are, life experiences, yours and those of the people who raised you, and your attitude toward money and credit in general. There are great online tools to help you determine your risk tolerance. Asset classes and diversification. The standard types of assets are stocks, fixed income or bonds, real estate, commodities like minerals, fossil fuels, crops, and foreign currencies. Often when one asset class is going up, another is going down. So diversifying across asset classes is one way people manage risk. FIers often diversify across asset classes through investing in a range of funds, bonds, stock, gold, and so on. In recent years, new asset classes have emerged, including peer-to-peer lending, loan funds, equity crowdfunding in companies, and green energy-related opportunities. Income. There are five ways you earn investment income. 1. Interest refers to periodic payments from fixed income investments such as bonds, notes, CDs, or savings accounts. 2. Dividends are a share of profits paid out to owners of stocks, mutual funds, ETFs, or private corporations. 3. Capital gains are the proceeds from the sale of investments or real estate beyond the amount originally invested. Capital losses happen when proceeds from a sale are less than the amount originally invested, reducing your passive income. 4. Rents are from owned real estate minus expenses like taxes, insurance, mortgage repairs, etc. 5. Royalties are payments to owners of intellectual property, natural resources, franchises, and so on by their users. Time. What's your time horizon? Do you have 20 more years to make mistakes and recover? Or are you already retired and needing your money to last longer than your life? Conventional wisdom, CW, suggests that when you are young, you should risk more for greater wealth accumulation. As you age, you shift to a focus on preservation of capital for a stable income. According to CW, a young person with decades until retirement should invest 90% in stocks and 10% in bonds because he or she can withstand booms or busts and still come out ahead. More conservative investors, or those simply trying to stabilize their wealth, such as soon-to-be retirees, may opt for 20% stocks and 80% bonds. As always, though, FIers tend to be more conservative than conventional wisdom would suggest, because they are aiming to retire much earlier and retain a high confidence that they'll stay above the crossover point even during market declines. Fees. The more middle people involved in your buying and selling of investments, and the more you buy and sell, the more transaction and management costs can add up and rob you of anticipated gains. Actively managed mutual funds need to pay their managers who presumably, but don't on average, do a better job at picking stocks than throwing a dart. Fee-only financial advisors can skim a percent off your whole portfolio to pay for their services or simply charge per hour for advice. Index funds have become a favorite of FIers because of low fees and, recently but not always, good performance. Financial advisors. Investing does not have to be a do-it-yourself mountain, unless you want it to be. You can hire an advisor to help or even use one of the online services or brokerage houses where they survey your goals, risk tolerance, values, and so on, and put together a portfolio for you. Be sure you aren't being corralled by unscrupulous brokers into buying products that pay them handsome commissions. Fee-only advisors work only for you and add value for many of us by doing nitty-gritty work we may not feel qualified or inclined to do, including monitoring performance, rebalancing holdings as market conditions change, and bigger picture financial planning. Be sure to shop around. Socially responsible investing. Are some of your values so important to you that investing in funds that include companies whose policies or products you abhor would cost you sleep? You're not alone, but fortunately there's a growing sector of investment offerings that screen out companies with objectionable, to some, practices like pollution, weapons manufacturing, or gender bias, just to name a few. Over time, socially responsible investments have generally matched or beaten the performance of unscreened investments. However, it typically costs slightly more in fees to tack on this extra layer of social and environmental research. A good FI response to this could be to examine the fee differential and ask yourself if, over the years, it will be worth paying the difference to support and be supported by investments that have all passed social, environmental, and governance checks. My own advisors at Natural Investments have kindly provided a brief explanation of socially responsible investing, or SRI. It follows. Because aligning money with values is a core of the FI program, SRI deserves serious consideration by FIers. None of us can escape the ethical implications of our financial choices in earning, spending, saving, and investing. In the world of finance, nothing is squeaky clean and fully laundered, but we can do our best to have our investments do the least harm and most good. In the nearly 50 years since its humble beginnings during the Vietnam War, when investors recoiled at their money supporting the war machine, SRI has become a $23 trillion industry globally. In the United States, 22% of all professionally managed money is in SRI. To put it simply, SRI seeks to, 1, avoid negative impacts, 2, seek positive impacts, and 3, influence the policies of the companies you've invested in. How? SRI uses research into social and environmental impacts to avoid investments with objectionable or irresponsible policies and practices, and to seek those that generate positive change for communities, society, and the environment. SRI also practices shareholder activism, which aims to hold companies accountable and improve corporate behavior, and incorporates community investing to foster local economies and the expansion of economic opportunities in the developing world. Today, a wide array of environmental, social, and governance ESG factors are assessed by SRI and conventional money managers. The financial world increasingly recognizes that environmental and resource-related concerns can be risks to corporate bottom lines. Pragmatism, not virtue, is driving some investors toward greener industries for a better long-term return. For example, some corporate investments in coal and oil may never be recovered through future profits, and investors have serious questions about the viability of fossil fuel companies over the coming decades. While society may be dragging its feet on the climate debate, insurance companies and the military have already incorporated climate change into their projections. SRI does not mean sacrifice of returns, though it still holds this reputation stemming from the early days. From the early 1990s on, return of SRI and ESG investments have matched or exceeded those of traditional unscreened investing. In addition, SRI investors reap social, environmental, and what could be called conscience returns. In a time of great uncertainty about climate and political stability, many people feel powerless. SRI is one way they find to put their hands on the wheel of the future. This glossary is meant to be informative, but not definitive or exhaustive. In the original version of this book, it was not needed since Joe had developed a set of criteria for FIRs, and one sort of investment fit that bill. Treasury bonds, Joe's plan. When Joe Dominguez retired just past his 31st birthday in 1969, there were fairly sturdy, set-it-and-forget-it passive income opportunities through both pensions and investing in U.S. Treasury and agency bonds to ensure maximum safety of capital and stability of monthly investment income. Interest rates on those bonds were above 6.5%, and inflation was below 3%, meaning a healthy annual profit for any investor. The next 30 years were the halcyon days of high interest rates, which spiked to nearly 15% during the recession of 1981 and floated back down to 6.5% in 1997, the year Joe died. The strategy he designed for himself in the 1960s and stood behind until he died took advantage of this rare opportunity. The chart in figure 9.1 in your PDF, developed by J.P. Livingston, founder of the website The Money Habit, is eloquent in illustrating why Joe chose and recommended treasury bonds. When Joe began teaching in 1980, he naturally recommended treasury bonds as the place to stash your cash. Tens of thousands of us did that and have remained FI ever since. Mike Lenich, whom we met earlier in Chapter 5, is one of them. He's done the program faithfully and to the letter since 1992. Readers since the turn of the millennium have sometimes looked at Joe's investment strategy with a combination of envy and disdain. Envy for those rates of return, disdain for the slowpokes who invest in bonds when the stock market offers such juicy alternatives for wealth creation. "Oh, that's the book about investing in treasury bonds," they say dismissively. In fact, it has never been. It's been about considering options, given your current circumstances, for having a safe, steady income throughout your life, apart from what you do with your time. For Joe, T-bonds fit that to a T. Joe set criteria for himself when it came to Stash's cash in 1969. He'd amassed $75,000, which would be $225,000 in today's dollars. With an average of 8% on his money, that provided just under $20,000 a year in today's dollars. Given his lifestyle, that was plenty. At today's interest rate, he would need four times that amount, close to that magic number of $1 million, to supply his frugal FI income. Even though Joe's strategy might no longer be applicable, it's still worth learning about for what it says about good principles of FI investing. His criteria were these. Greatest safety of capital. Greatest safety of interest. Full faith and credit of the U.S. government guarantees protection of principal and interest. Exemption from state and local taxes. Non-callability. Most treasury bonds can't be redeemed early by the issuer. Greatest negotiability. Absolute liquidity. Global marketability. They can be bought and sold almost instantly with minimal handling charges and in convenient denominations, such as 1,000, 5,000, and 10,000. Easiest availability, directly from the federal government, Treasury Direct, and through most brokers and many banks anywhere in the world. Cheapest availability, no middlemen, no commissions, no loads. Duration. The range of maturities available is extensive. You can buy a note or a bond that will mature in a few months or one that won't come due for 30 years. Absolute stability of income over the long run. Ideal for FI, avoids the income fluctuations that would occur with the money market funds, renting out real estate, etc. A primer on treasury bonds. A bond is simply an IOU. The bond issuer promises to pay back to the holder of the bond the amount printed on the bond, face value, by a certain date, maturity date. Most bonds also pay interest at a specific percentage rate, called a coupon rate. This amount, though, quoted as an annual percentage rate, is usually paid in two semi-annual installments. Treasury bonds are the government's way of borrowing money. A new bond is issued for purchase every few months, with maturity dates 10, 20, and 30 years into the future. The first thing that each new issue does is pay off the holders of the old issues coming due. The remaining monies are used to make up the deficit in the federal budget. The national debt is the most senior obligation of the government. Principal and interest on treasury securities must be paid when they come due before paying for anything else. Not to do so would destroy the credit rating of the U.S. government in world markets. Back when Joe and I invested, the world was sufficiently nervous about the ability of the U.S. to repay, meaning our government had to pay a high interest rate to attract the loans it needed to stay afloat. Ergo, those amazing opportunities for FIers. 30-year treasury bonds were a golden opportunity for a set-it-and-forget-it FI strategy. Bond prices fluctuate with prevailing interest rates. Therefore, if you sell a bond before maturity, you may get more or less than you paid for it. That's the market risk. If you hold it until maturity, you will receive exactly its face value, regardless of the interest rate prevailing at the time. Treasury bonds, when they are newly issued, can be bought directly from the Federal Reserve, with no commission whatsoever, through a program called Treasury Direct. This cuts out the middleman, no broker, no added brokerage house fees. You can also buy existing Treasury bonds through a broker for a minimal fee. The other way for an individual to buy Treasuries, any issue, not just the most recent one, is through the secondary market from a willing seller. You might pay more or less than the face value, given prevailing interest rates. You may also pay a minimal fee or commission upon purchase. Some people prefer to buy bonds on the secondary market instead of directly from the U.S. government because they prefer to trade with a real person who owns the bond rather than financing the U.S. debt. While interest rates on U.S. Treasury bills, bonds, and notes fell to a low point of under 2% in 2012 and are still very low, there's no telling whether or when this tide will turn, and you will return to this section. If you like the low risk of bonds but don't want to bet on just one, you can buy bond funds, which will be described later. Joe did not recommend corporate bonds, but some FIers may find them attractive if they are trying to eke out a bit more interest. Like U.S. Treasury and agency bonds, they are debt instruments, interest paid quarterly or biannually, and at maturity you get your principal back. Like government bonds, they have a credit rating with Standard & Poor's or Moody's or one of the other rating agencies. Look for BBB or better. SRI investors who still want to benefit from the safety of the full faith and credit of the U.S. government may want to look at U.S. agency bonds instead of Treasury bonds. Agency bonds support a specific sector you might care about, like farmers or students or homeowners or small businesses, while Treasury bonds fund the overall priorities of the federal budget, heavy with military and debt repayment obligations. A caveat. Joe always tried to give novices the minimum information needed to invest with assurance. But with his advice, he always delivered a warning. Nothing is certain. Nothing. That's life. If you don't like it, you're out of luck. If someone tells you he or she has a foolproof method for making money effortlessly and you follow it, Joe would have said, you are the fool. Here's a cautionary tale. In the old days, when Joe taught only interested friends his FI approach, he would give them a gift when they reached FI3, financial independence. He'd give them a bond, a yellowing Russian czarist bond. Before there were online brokerage accounts or registered bonds, bonds had coupons that you actually clipped and brought into the bank to get your semi-annual interest. The coupons on Joe's gift bonds were clipped all the way until 1917, when the Russian Revolution rendered them worthless. 50 years later, Joe bought a box of these bonds for a penny or so apiece, thinking at the time they'd make amusing wallpaper. Giving them to newly minted FIers was his reminder that no investment you make guarantees that geopolitical or economic conditions will not shift or protect you from finding that the nest egg you thought would give you a comfortable income for life won't. Buyer of investments, beware. Low-cost index funds, the FIRE plan. If not Treasury bonds, then what? The majority of FIRE bloggers rely on and recommend investing in some form of index fund. John Bogle, who founded investment management company Vanguard in 1975, struck on a revolutionary principle that made investing accessible and simple, returning net profits to his shareholder in the form of low costs. By eliminating sales commissions and minimizing operating expenses, Vanguard opened the door to the little guy and to other companies like Fidelity and Schwab. For FI investors who have learned when enough is enough, particularly in terms of their money, index funds are as close as set it and forget it as you can get outside of bonds. Legendary investor Warren Buffett said, "A low-cost fund is the most sensible equity investment for a great majority of investors." He explains, by periodically investing in an index fund, for example, the know-nothing investor can actually outperform most investment professionals. Index funds are mutual funds or exchange-traded funds, ETFs, designed to track the performance of stock market indices, such as the Dow Jones Industrial, the NASDAQ Composite, the S&P 500, or bond market indices. In using index funds to invest your capital, you are not trying to beat the market. There's no attempt to use traditional active money management or to make bets on individual stocks. Indexing is a passive investment approach emphasizing broad diversification and low portfolio trading activity. Instead, you are looking for enough of a return to meet your short-term as well as long-term goals while taking as little risk as possible. This is why index funds, with their low fees and potential for diversification, can work well for the FI investment program. However, unlike bonds, stock index funds are invested in a pool of stocks that do fluctuate with the market. Millennial FIRE fans use stock index funds like boomers used banks, keeping a little liquid cash on hand and investing the rest in these funds. People who've lived through boom and bust cycles may cringe at the idea of treating a stock market product, inherently risky, like a bank, inherently safe. But for young people who've only seen the Dow go up and up, not investing in index funds seems dumb, considering the upside rewards and the tax advantage when it's done inside an IRA or a 401k. However, remember Joe's buyer beware warning. Over the past 90 years, the stock market has taken five big hits, 32 to 86% drops, with recovery times afterwards ranging from 4 to 27 years. At the risk of finger wagging, here are some data. Great Depression, down 86%, 27 years to recover. Mid-1970s, down 46%, almost a decade to recover. Late 1987, down 32% in just 3 months, 4 years to recover. Great Recession, 2007-09, down 50%, 6 years to recover, or 14 years if you count the matching dot-com peak in 1999, which had just been regained in 2007. The two events within the lifetime of young investors, the dot-com crash and the 2007-09 crisis, were exceptions in that they took less than a decade to recover. But that doesn't mean the cyclical nature of the market has been suspended. By contrast, bond funds are less volatile, losing only a few percentage points when they falter. The index fund philosophy. Bogleheads, as followers of John Bogle call themselves, believe they can successfully manage risk and achieve greater returns than the average investor, many of whom are trying to time the market or make it big on the next hot tech stock. Their advice boils down to the following philosophy. Invest in low-fee index funds diversified over a few asset classes and hold them for many years. So how do people ensure the funds are low fee? Index funds, by their very nature, are passively managed, as opposed to more expensive actively managed investments. With index funds, there's no picking and choosing. For managed funds, like mutual funds, a manager picks the investments trying to outperform the market index. Because there's less administrative management for index funds, fees are lower and more attractive to investors. These fees, or expense ratios, are charged as a percentage of your wealth. Note that there are SRI options in index fund realm as well. The fees, 0.22 to 0.5%, are much lower than those of mutual funds, but higher than non-SRI index funds. The last element you should consider is diversifying your index funds across asset classes. While many index funds are low cost and simple, investors will still have a few choices to make. For example, there are stocks and bonds, domestic and international, large, medium, and small capital funds, and any combination of the above. It can be a U.S. bond index fund or an international stock index fund. These combinations allow you to expose yourself to various parts of the world market and reduce your overall risk. take advantage of company plans. For those in their earning years, many employer retirement plans or individual IRAs will offer low-cost index funds. If your employer offers a retirement plan, review your options for passively managed low-cost index funds. Always be sure to get the full employer match if you can. It's worth it. By contributing to retirement accounts during your working years, recall that you're reducing your overall taxes while saving for your future. If you don't have an employer plan, you can still invest in an IRA through a brokerage house. This is similar to opening a checking or savings account, but with the potential for long-term growth. As you'll soon find out, following the aforementioned advice will narrow your fund choices down to only a few options. If this is starting to sound boring, well, then you're doing it right. Long-term investing is not a get-rich-quick scheme or something to micromanage. Companies like Vanguard pioneered the way with simple, no-strings-attached investing. What was once more expensive and convoluted is now accessible to anyone. Nevertheless, there are now many companies to choose from. The most important thing is understanding that no one, and we mean no one, can time the market or predict the future. Understand your risk tolerance and diversify into stocks, bonds, and domestic and international index funds to reduce your overall risk. Since landing the perfect mix of asset classes is impossible, the most important thing is reducing exposure to one single government or company. Review the expense ratios or fees of each fund. As with most long-term investments, stay the course and tune out 24-hour financial media. The only days you care about an investment's values are the day you buy it and the day you sell it. Do people really do this? Many popular FI luminaries have rocketed to the forefront of mainstream media with flashy headlines. Want to retire early? How about your early 30s? And saving 50% of your income will lead to early retirement. It's no surprise that these links get so many clicks. But when you dig right down, you find that many people popularizing the FI movement are following some form of the strategy we've outlined. J.L. Collins, author of The Simple Path to Wealth, writes about his financial approach in a series of letters to his daughter. Through these conversations, he is smacked with reality that people like money, but they also like it simple. He boils his fatherly advice down to short bullet points, including sensible policies like avoid fiscally irresponsible people and save a portion of every dollar you get. More pointedly, he advises her to spend far less than she makes and invest the remainder in Vanguard's Total Stock Market Index Fund, VTSAX. One account, one fund. Can it really be this easy? Possibly the biggest star in the FI blogger heavens and the author of the foreword to this book is Mr. Money Mustache. He has touted his relationship with index funds for years, calling individual stocks a sucker's bet. On his blog, he advises his readers to spend 10 to 15 years working and living the good life off less than 50% of their income while also shoveling money into index funds and long-term, low-cost investments. Contrary to most, he thinks of market crashes as blowout sale on stocks. While acknowledging real estate and other income sources, he encourages his readers to continue making money for them through index funds. The minimalists, Joshua Fields Milburn and Ryan Nicodemus, are bloggers and authors of a popular book, Minimalism, Living a Meaningful Life. They walk the walk when it comes to simple investing. They document their financial tool of choice as, you guessed it, index funds. Flexible, low-cost, and reliable. They highlight huge savings on switching to low-cost money management brokers such as Vanguard and Betterment, another investment management firm offering strong competition to the world of simple investing in the form of automated investing. And finally, Mr. and Mrs. Frugalwoods identify their low-cost, low-fuss money management system as investing excess cash in index funds. Sure sounds familiar. In a post describing their strategy, they hit the nail on the head with this one. Quote, "Our culture has a shroud of mystery surrounding investment, which is completely uncalled for. There's no need to pay someone to manage your investments because, get this, low-cost index funds outperform managed funds." End quote. If there are a few simple rules to remember from the Bogleheads, it's the following. 1. Pay off debt and avoid it in the future. 2. Live below your means by spending less than you earn. 3. Invest the rest in low-cost index funds. 4. Hold on to funds for many years. Puzzling through these options, through risks and rewards of different paths, Tammy I decided to split her investment portfolio using the enough and then some description of the nest egg you have at crossover. She invests the bulk of her money in treasury bonds, so she knows that no matter what the world throws her way, she has enough income to cover her basics. But the and then some is her cash, which she invests in mutual and index funds, much like the strategies we've outlined. More risk, but potentially more reward. And more cash. Should she lose it all, she's still FI, and she can slowly over time build her cash back up. Real estate. The next strategy we'll explore is investing in real estate. After putting down roots in your favorite community, purchasing an income-producing asset, such as a duplex or quad, can be an excellent FI plan. Not only do you manage property for people in your community, but tenants pay your mortgage and provide a steady stream of income for years. Scott Trench, author of Set for Life, is a real estate advisor, broker, and blogger. He says, quote, "Folks all over the country are learning that if they can buy a home, they can buy an investment property. Often, small duplexes, triplexes, and quads can be had for right around the same purchase price as a single-family home. At 4 units or less, folks with solid credit and income can use FHA or low down payment as low as 3.5% to purchase income-producing property, so long as they live in that property for at least a year. The experience for many, including myself, can be phenomenal, as those that do their homework and learn the basics of tenant management can select quiet, friendly neighbors that are financially well qualified to rent the property and have a strong credit score. It's just like living in a home. And yes, you complete the small maintenance issues that every single homeowner in the country is responsible for. The difference is that you are paid thousands of dollars from tenants to take care of your home." Here is his checklist for evaluating a multifamily building. 1. Is the property in a location that you are comfortable with being a part of your life for the next few years or even indefinitely? 2. Is the property in a location that you believe has good prospects? Is it likely to appreciate? Is the neighborhood likely to stay attractive and safe? 3. What is the property expected to generate in terms of gross rent? 4. What are the expected expenses? Common ones are repairs, utilities, any homeowner association fees, taxes, CapEx, capital expenses, those months between tenants when units are vacant, and any management fees if you don't choose to do it yourself. This adds up to needing a substantial kitty in the tens of thousands going into the purchase. Unlike other investments, real estate ties up a lot of your wealth in one investment that is not very liquid. If you are in a hurry to sell to get your money out and the housing market is weak, you might lose. There's risk, but if you are willing to do the hard work yourself and have picked well, your rental properties can be a safe, steady income for life. A caution. There's a subset of real estate investors who make money by, quote-unquote, flipping properties, buying fixer-uppers, fixing them up, and selling at hefty profit. This may be a strategy for some FIers in their wealth accumulation phase, but it fails the test for an FI portfolio. There's too much work, too much risk, and frankly, the possibility of displacing fixed-income poor tenants who might not be able to afford to stay in their familiar neighborhood with its well-formed social networks. Another kind of real estate investing is investing in your own home and land in ways that are integral to your FI vision. Investing in renewable energy for your home and in farmstead infrastructure, gardens, barns, coops, and pens, will pay dividends for decades. While their money may be in index funds, Mr. and Mrs. Frugalwoods, for example, are building a rural homestead. Kent and Beth were both highly paid professionals when they met. Part of their attraction to one another, though, wasn't a shared high life. Kent, a PhD who read the huge handwriting on the wall about climate change, was a green energy consultant for a city in the South. He'd banked on making his city a model of sustainability, but he became increasingly distressed when few of his ideas made it through the bureaucracy. Beth knew that her corporate job was part of the problem, and it troubled her. They'd saved enough to leave their jobs and run a small farm outside the city to get their feet dirty. Then drought hit. The deep water wells ran dry. The crops wilted. The climate modeling Kent had studied in grad school was suddenly very real. They decided to head west in a motorhome and find a climate safe or safer place to settle. After many months, they found it, an undervalued, rundown house being consumed by blackberry bushes on 8 acres of lush forest land in the Pacific Northwest. A portion of the property line bordered on a main highway, so the whole property was zoned commercial. They decided to make homesteading and raising a family there their full-time job, with a twist. Living in their motorhome, they rescued the house from blackberries. Then they renovated a ground-floor mother-in-law apartment, the rent from which pays their mortgage. Once the main floor was livable, they rented out their motorhome. Then they fixed up an outbuilding for another rental. The income from that will go to a building closer to the highway for commercial use. They'll flatten their mortgage in 6 years rather than 20 or 30 and consider their fertile soil, plentiful water, and rentals their natural and enduring wealth. They had one child when they bought the property, another when they'd settled in. They believe with all their hearts that raising woods-wise, conscious children, providing affordable housing, liberating all their time for parenting and service, and networking locally to make their community a lifeboat are the best things they can do for their future and the planet's. In another vein, real estate doesn't have to mean a place to live. It can, as George Carlin once said, be a place for your stuff. Todd T. did his own version of real estate investing by purchasing a self-storage facility and having on-site and off-site managers run the project on a daily basis. Yes, of course, this is in part profiting from consumer excess, having more stuff than house to put it in. Irony aside, Todd and his family collect enough per month that they've been able to live and save enough to buy a second facility. He's chosen a life of community service, occupying roles of significant responsibility, like the school board, for example. He is able to be bold in his service because he has that passive income to actively support his life. Real estate can also be part of a larger investment strategy. Dorothy E. and her husband, Larry D., whose story encompasses the full range of this program's values, crossed over in 1995 with $400,000 in assets. They had, on and off, up to 3 rental properties, leveraging the value of their house. They also rented out part of their main residence as a mother-in-law apartment. Beyond their stable real estate investments and income, they made a hobby with their and then some money of investing in individual companies as well as mutual funds. To become knowledgeable and sophisticated about equity investments, they educated themselves through the NAIC, the National Association of Investors Corporation, and helped found several different investment clubs over the years. These are the principles they follow. 1. Invest a set amount regularly. 2. Reinvest earnings, dividends, and profits. 3. Invest in quality growth stocks and equity mutual funds. And 4. Diversify your investments. Larry said, joining an investment club was a safe and fun way to educate ourselves about investing in individual stocks. The point of investment clubs is learning about investments, not getting rich. We took the insights and knowledge gained at the club meetings and applied them to our own investments. The next profit area was plugging the drain in their nest egg caused by taxes. Having learned the ins and outs of the tax code, Larry notes, quote, more than half of our investments are in tax-deferred vehicles, IRAs, 401ks, etc., as a way to keep more of what we earn and have earned. To that end, we keep a spreadsheet that forecasts our cash flow through the next 10 years or more, and that's when we can access the tax-deferred accounts without penalty. And if hard times hit before then, we still have access to our money if we're willing to accept the penalties. Their final cash stream is pure your money or your life. They always live below their means. The upshot, they've tripled their nest egg. Larry has worked on volunteer projects that sometimes produce some income, and Dorothy has chosen to work part-time at a job she enjoys, doing it not so much for the money as for love. My choices. Multiple socially responsible income streams. Luckily, I bought the majority of my bonds from 1981 through 1997. I had one bond with a coupon rate of 15%. My lowest was 8%. All but the last have matured. I hated to see them go. The 30-year term was up, and the U.S. government returned my money for me to invest again at 5% and under. Until the turn of the millennium, bonds were my only investment. Since then, I've diversified without compromising my values. Even if your values aren't exactly the same as mine, I hope my example will help you make your investments reflect your own. For me to be happy and free, my investing has to align with my values. I have worked to end overconsumption in North America for 30 years in light of what I know about the toxicity, pollution, and climate cost of our industrial growth economy. I'm not such a purist that I eschew making money on my money, but I try to invest with my values. I drive an electric car and invest in solar industries. I buy from local farm stands and invest in local farms. I work to build a more diverse local economy, and I invest in local businesses. I see my community graying and want to reverse that trend, so I often will trade with younger people for partial rent in apartments I own. Where I put my money reflects who I am, as it will for you, whatever your choices. This is inescapable. Real estate. In 1986, Joe and I and some friends bought a sprawling house in Seattle for $137,000. For 20 years, it housed our nonprofit, the New Roadmap Foundation, and over half dozen people. I owned a portion of the house, and by the time we sold it, I'd live rent-free for 20 years and tripled my money when we sold. This way of investing, while accidental, as in we needed a stable place to live in Seattle, impressed me. Had we rented, my portion over 20 years would have been easily $75,000. Plus, I collected rent from other housemates along the way. Plus, I had something tangible and tradable, a house with 7 bedrooms. Plus, I provided a home for dozens of people over the years. Plus, I lived in a great part of the world. Plus, I had community, one of the pillars of wealth, where a lot of internal horse trading went on, haircuts for health advice for tax help. For me, this constitutes socially responsible investing. After the sale, I was able to buy a house in the community where I live on Whidbey Island, a story worth telling. With that Seattle house money sitting in the bank at 1% interest at best, I considered whether buying more treasury bonds was a good choice, given the 3% coupon rate at the time. Thinking about my Seattle house, I searched for an equivalent, perhaps a duplex where I could live on one side and rent the other. One snowy winter day when my village was at a standstill, I saw a reasonably priced house listed online just half a mile up the hill from the apartment I was renting. I trudged up in my sorrel boots to find a conventional people box, a split-entry light green three-bedroom house looking quite large and, frankly, ugly. Circling around back, I found a deck, climbed the stairs, and looked through the sliding glass door to a view of Mount Baker, the North Cascades, and the waters of Puget Sound. A view home in a village that often ranks among the top seaside towns, my mind started to whir. Still, I'd need to take on debt to buy it. I'd paid cash my whole life and wasn't eager to break my no-debt track record. This place would need to be a site of production rather than a site of consumption. It needed to be a money source, not a money sink. To fill my coffers, not empty them. I thought of the possibilities. I could rent the garage to a woodworker or a boat or motorhome owner. I could rent the large family room with a bathroom on the ground floor to someone without losing privacy on the main floor. My mind, like a cash register, ka-chinged away, figuring out how I'd swing it while I trudged back home. I was already mentally dickering, shaving $5,000 at a time off the price of the house and rehearsing how I'd make my pitch to the real estate agent. In short order, two things happened. First, I called an acquaintance who'd just taken a job on Whidbey to ask if she'd like to rent the family room. "Why don't I buy the house with you instead?" she responded. We each, it turned out, had enough cash from the sale of our prior homes to pay for half. Second, the bank decided the house had been on its books too long and dropped the price by $40,000, making it a bargain. The inspection revealed some maintenance problems, but it was still doable, and we nabbed it. 9 years later, my co-owner first converted the family room to a private apartment, and then, because she had to move back home to take care of her mother, I bought her out. I've converted the garage to another studio apartment. Each fetches a rent that is more than fair to both tenants and landlady. I have a big garden in the backyard that gets full southern sun, and I rent my guest room in the summer on Airbnb. Living in a tourist town helps. By my calculations, I realize 8% annually on my investment, an excellent return in this era of low interest rates. In a pinch, when I'm older, I might be able to turn the house into a bank, using it as collateral for a loan to cover replacing one or another body part. I also figure that a caregiver could live in one of those apartments for free as partial trade for a couple hours a day of keeping me washed, dressed, and fed. Social Security. Social Security is a third income stream. I began receiving my Social Security 2 years early, calculating it would take 20 years for the wee bit more I would get by waiting to equal the amount I would get for 2 years by starting. Would I last that long? With Social Security? It was right after buying my current house, and I was cash poor, so I chose to start. Unlike many boomers, I have no additional pensions from long-term employment with benefits. Luckily, also unlike many other boomers, I have a diversity of investments and am not relying on the meager check I get each month. Local lending. My fourth income stream after bonds, real estate, and Social Security comes from local lending. In Community I Trust isn't just a philosophical accessory I wear. It's an ethic I live, and I found a way to do it relatively safely. In a neighboring community, a group of practical visionaries set up a unique network called LION, Local Investing Opportunities Network, which helped connect investors with local small businesses and nonprofits that had business opportunities but lacked cash. In this model, the network simply invites people with new or existing businesses to submit letters of interest, backed by a business plan, to a secretary who distributes these opportunities to members. Any interested member can meet with the business owner, learn about his or her opportunity, and negotiate an investment for whatever amount on whatever terms. Since community and relationships are core to my wealth, I have my own little revolving loan fund, through which I have to date put close to $80,000 into local businesses. I ask for about 5% on all my loans, some of which I take in product, cat litter, vegetables, a chicken coop, eggs, the stuff rural life is made of. In almost all cases, my borrowers are grateful and become my friends. When they flourish, my community flourishes. Important because rural communities have to have a flourishing economy to stay vital and prosperous. Green energy. When a local group jumped through many hoops to install a large bank of solar panels on our island, I jumped at the opportunity to buy into the LLC, Limited Liability Corporation, they formed for the deal. With government incentive payments plus sale of the electricity, I am profiting in three ways. I'm supporting a solar installation on my island, an investment in an energy self-sufficient future. I'm realizing 3% of my money with almost no risk. And our LLC hired a local company to install made-in-Washington panels, supporting local economic development. My ability to find and invest in other green energy and socially responsible businesses has not been quite so simple. For this reason, I engaged a fee-only financial advisor who specializes in this area. Since I have little interest in actively managing my money, the small percentage she takes every year is more than worth it. If I paid myself for the hours I'd invest in researching socially responsible, or at least not socially noxious, investment opportunities, plus paying for the health toll of the stress, I'm quite risk-averse, it could well exceed his fee. My advisor is uniquely attuned to my investment philosophy. He was instrumental in developing the local investing strategy in the neighboring town that my community adopted. Also, his company, Natural Investments, has a roadmap for investing that matches my approach. With part of my money, what's coming back to me from those deliciously high coupon bonds, I've decided to take more risk than normal to invest in companies he's identified that will sell shares to small investors. I own a stake in 2 solar companies and a coffee cooperative. For the rest, my money is in socially responsible stocks and bond funds. If you decide to hire a financial advisor, make sure he or she's not only high integrity, but also has values that match yours. Side hustles. Like many FIers these days, I also make a bit of money from what are currently referred to as side hustles, which are simply additional ways to bring in income. There's no end to the creativity of these micro jobs, from having an online store to selling products on eBay, from keeping a few consulting and coaching clients even after FI, to walking dogs, to staging houses, to writing blogs, to tutoring kids, to being a tour guide in the summer, to, as I do, occasionally keynoting a conference. While writing a book is an elephant of a side hustle, it also fits here because it's episodic, it snugs into my diverse life activities, and it could disappear without crashing my financial independence. Checklist of things to consider when investing. 1. Is this investment in line with my values? 2. Is this investment in line with my tolerance for risk? 3. Does this provide overall diversification for my investments? 4. Does this provide the current and future income I need? 5. How easily can I liquidate, sell out of, all or part of this investment? 6. What sales charges or penalties, if any, will I incur in getting into or out of this investment? 7. What are the federal, state, and local tax implications of this investment for me? Is it tax efficient for my income bracket or situation? You will construct an FI portfolio that matches your ways of thinking and of living, your tolerance for risk, and your creativity in applying consciousness rather than money to meeting your needs. It is truly up to you. In conclusion, You are well on your way to taking back the power you have given over to money and to money experts. You are ready to become a conscious, loving, and knowledgeable steward of your life energy. Our greatest hope is that